If you're a longtime listener of the podcast, you know that I have recently gone back to school to get a degree in philosophy with a minor in literature. Well, this week I've had some fascinating opportunities to study the point of literature. Why do we even need it in our lives? I'm going to get into that today, as well as share a powerful recommendation I think you're going to love in the world of short stories. All right, let's get into it. Welcome to this week's episode of the Read Well podcast. My name is Eddie Hood, and I'm your host, where I believe it's more important to read well than to be well read. So grab your favorite book, open up your notes, and let's get ready to learn something fascinating. Hey everyone, welcome back. I've had such a fun week. I just want to give you a quick update. We had just this great book club the past Tuesday. If you're part of that, you know that we have dug into the book The Idiot by Fyodor Dostoevsky. We have had more people than ever joining the book club, and the conversation has just been so uplifting and so encouraging. I'm loving it. In fact, one of the members of the club wrote a little message in the private community that I host mentioning that she wants to read all the Russian classics, but gets agitated when she sits down to read. She mentions that lifelong habit of feeling that she should be doing something else sort of sabotages her. And she also mentions that she just started my 30-day focused reader challenge, which is another course available to members of the reading community that I host online. And she's really finding value in that because we start off slow with a few minutes a day and some practiced exercises as well as mental exercises to build that reader focus and help her and myself and everybody else to become better and more focused readers. So I just want to thank all of you for coming to the book club and for being a part of that. If you're interested in joining the book club, that's the only thing that I charge for in all of this content, and it's just $9 a month. The reason for the charge is because I incur a lot of software costs and meeting costs so that we can meet virtually and share content and everything together. So that's what that's for. And if you want to learn about it, you can go to thereadwellpodcast.com. And then up in the navigation, you'll see the link for the book club. All right, well, let's get into this main question today of why do we even need literature? And my professors have given me this massive book to purchase, as all college courses seem to do. It's called the Norton Introduction to Literature, and they've got me reading it's called the Shorter 14th Edition, and I think shorter is hilarious because this book is over 2,000 pages long. I want to know what the longer edition looks like. Anyway, I would like to read the first two paragraphs to this introduction because it does a wonderful job of explaining why literature is so important. Okay, here we go. In the opening chapters of Charles Dickens' novel, Hard Times, published in 1854, the aptly named Thomas Gradgrind warns teachers and pupils at his model school to avoid using their imaginations. "Teach these boys and girls nothing but facts. Facts alone are wanted in life," exclaims Mr. Gradgrind. To press his point, Mr. Gradgrind asks girl number 20, Sissy Jupe, the daughter of a circus performer, to define a horse. When she cannot, Gradgrind turns to Bitzer, a pale, spiritless boy who looked as though if he were cut, he would bleed white. A quote-unquote model student of this quote-unquote model school, Bitzer gives exactly the kind of definition to satisfy Mr. Gradgrind. Quadrupled, gramnivorous, 40 teeth, namely 24 grinders, 4 eyed teeth, and 12 incisive. Sheds coat in spring, in marshy countries, sheds hoofs. Anyone who has any sense of what a horse is rebels against Bitzer's lifeless picture of that animal and against the Gradgrind view of reality. As these first scenes of Hard Times lead us to expect, in the course of the novel, the fact-grinding Mr. Gradgrind learns that human beings cannot live on facts alone, that it is dangerous to stunt the faculties of imagination and feeling, that, in words of one of the novel's more lovable characters, people must be amused. Through the downfall of the exaggerated enemy of the imagination, Dickens reminds us that we must like and even need to read literature. So that's the opening paragraph to this massive textbook, and I loved it because it really points out the idea that If all we did was live in a black and white existence with complete rationality and no thought for emotion or passion or a sense of beauty, the aesthetic of life, we would live in a lifeless and spiritless world. In fact, many philosophers argue that the way to transcend the mundane of life is to do so through aesthetics. Philosophers like Nietzsche felt this, that the best way to really overcome the grind of life was through the beauty of music and art and an appreciation of the higher form of creativity. Now, here is a philosophical explanation for why we should read literature. Again, in this textbook, we are referencing the poet Keats, and it says, Keats' friend and fellow poet Percy Bysshe Shelley argues that literature increases a person's ability to make leaps, to imagine intensely and comprehensively, and to put himself in the place of another and of many other people, as one has in order to be greatly good. So Shelley meant good in a moral sense, reasoning that ability both to accurately imagine and to truly feel the human consequences of our actions is the key to ethical behavior. So these poets are arguing that we need literature so that we can see the world from another person's point of view. I mean, how else are you going to stand in the shoes of a slave or a Roman emperor or somebody who is trying to endure a difficult marriage or to raise teenagers and not know what you're doing? Literature offers us the opportunity to experience these lives without having to endure the physical pain of them. And that is one of the beauties of books, because we can gain not only some sort of emotional connection to other people, as well as a patience for what they may or may not be going through, but a real sense of clarity on who we are and how we can better live our lives. Without reading these stories, we are not exposed to these ideas and instead only have a limited amount of information, our own personal life, in order to make decisions with. And I don't know about you, but my life is limited. I have lived in pretty much the same area most of my life. I only know maybe a couple hundred people out of the millions in the world. I have mostly lived in a very blessed sort of setting. I get that I sort of won the earthly lottery of being born where I was born and into a family that could take care of me and love me and all of that stuff. So I really can't relate to people who are born in poor or impoverished countries, people who are struggling with socioeconomic restraints. And so books allow me to at least open my eyes, at least be considerate of what's happening out there. And I think the older I get and the more I read, the more open I am to everybody. And it's been a really beautiful experience, because growing up, you know, you tend to have lots of opinions. You think you know everything when you're a teenager. You're unharmable. You are Superman. You are the all-knowing. But as you get older, you get a little wiser. And especially if you are willing to read books outside of your current worldview. And what it's done, I used to feel uncomfortable around specific groups of people growing up. You know, I didn't fit in. I didn't know how to react or engage with them. They might have had different values than me and so on. But now that I am older, I have found I can go into pretty much any public setting and I just enjoy being with people. I love hearing their stories. I love knowing about their background. I want to just go to lunch with them and hang out. So I think books have really helped me, at least, to do that. Now, there's one last quote in this textbook I want to read to you. I found this introduction so great, because we on the Readable podcast, well, me, talk a lot about why we even need books. I think books are the greatest gift we can give future generations, right? How do we package what we know and then give it as a form of knowledge to other people? And there's one sentence in this whole book that just knocked me on my pants, and it said, "What we do with literature alters what it does to us." Now let's unpack that. Literature is a two-way street. It is not something that is just, you know, when you have time, you open up a book, you read a few pages, and then you walk away. If you read a book properly, you slow down and you read it well, that book will change you. Now, how it changes you depends on what you bring to the book. So, you know, I first read The Wealth Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson when I was 9 years old, and I loved it. It was a story then of seeking treasure and adventure and all of these sort of great boyish adventures. And it's still those things. But now that I am past my, you know, midlife crisis sort of situation, I'm almost 44 now, If I were to read that book again, I guarantee you, after having launched a business, raised children, been married for 20 years, fallen in love with books and these kinds of things, if I were to read that book now, I am bringing a different set of tools, a different set of experience, and that book would mean something entirely different to me. And so it's really important, one, to know that every time you read a book, you are going to probably get something different out of it. And two, if you're able to read a book with other people, that you get the sort of the benefit and the privilege of them bringing their experience and their knowledge to that story in ways that will open up the different layers of it to you. Now, this is what I'm experiencing in Fyodor Dostoevsky's The Idiot, because we're reading that in the book club that I host online. And every week I prepare my notes and go through it as meticulously as I can, trying to understand the historical context, the characters, and the background, because I'm ultimately in charge of leading this wonderful online discussion. But every time I do that, I get online and I get to face this screen of all of these intelligent, sort of thoughtful and kind and just curious readers. They all bring these fantastic insights that I had never thought of, and the book just gets 10 times more interesting. And again, it's because some of them are coming from different backgrounds, different education levels, and on and on. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful experience. So the ultimate question, do we need literature in our lives? And the argument is yes, of course we need it. As pointed out in the introduction, and by referencing Charles Dickens' book, Hard Times, we need literature to add color to our lives. If we only live by facts and by reasoning, by a yes or no answer, right? If we ignore the gray areas of life, then we will live a spiritless, lifeless existence. And that is not what I want, at least for myself. I want to wake up every day knowing it could be my last and be so excited to go out and live who I am and be what I am. But it is hard to do if the only thing I do is wake up, go to work, make dinner, go to bed, rinse and repeat, right? Somewhere in there, I need to inject some sort of art, some culture, some aesthetic value. And literature is such a great input for our lives. Because here's the thing, I heard it explained to me recently that, you know, if you go to a museum, for example, and you look at a painting, you could sit and look at that painting for hours and sort of watch the meaning of it change to you. But even then, a picture conveys its meaning pretty quickly, right? You see it, you see the scene and the people and the coloring, and your brain makes pretty quick sense of that. And then you can sort of explore the ideas, but within about 30 seconds, you know what that painting is about. A book is entirely different. Oftentimes, you'll start a book not knowing at all what you are getting into. And so there is this mental process that takes place from page one to the end of the book, where you really have to be present and hear the characters and sort of smell the smells and put yourself into that world. I can't think of another medium of art that does that for you. The written word has the ability to sort of grab you, and you have to give yourself to it fully so that you can get the most out of it. With any other art form, again, if I were to look at a painting or, you know, some pottery, or if I were to listen to music, I can technically do other things and still feel uplifted by those art forms, right? I could go to the museum and I could put on my headphones and I could listen to some music or a podcast, and I could still look at that painting and be moved by it. I could listen to Beethoven or Bach and I could wash the dishes and I could still be moved by it. But with a book, it's a little different. For me, at least, I find it's hard to be doing other things while I'm reading literature. I have to turn my world off in order to open up this new world. And because I have to give up so much in order to get something from it, the amount I receive is tenfold. I've noticed that what I bring to the book is what it gives back to me. You know, if I'm trying to multitask or just kind of get my reading in for the day so I can check it off, I don't usually get much out of that reading session. But if I sit down, and I prefer to read in the mornings because my mind is fresh and I sort of have that opportunity to connect, you know, you make a cup of coffee and you can sit with your book and really enjoy it. To give yourself to that book and decide that for the next hour or 30 minutes or even 10 minutes, however long you have to read, you're not going to listen to podcasts or watch YouTube videos, or you're not going to check your work email. Instead, you are going to submit yourself to the work of this author. And if you can do that, then the literature will give back so much more to you. I'd like to take just a second to hit pause on this show to tell you about the readwellpodcast.com. If you go there, you can subscribe to my weekly newsletter on reading deeply. Simply go to thereadwellpodcast.com, enter your email, and I'll send you a message every Wednesday at 9 a.m. on how to become a deep and thoughtful reader. Thanks for listening. Let's get back to the show. Well, as always, I'd like to give you a recommendation for reading this week. This is going to be a little different, something I'm really excited to share with you. I've always been sort of profoundly impacted by shorter works of fiction because I feel like as much as I love novels, and I often and most of the time talk about either nonfiction or larger works of fiction here on the podcast, but if you know me, you know I am a huge fan of essays because essays have a very short amount of time frame in which they can get a specific point across. Novels are sprawling, right? So they will often cover many themes, many characters, many ideas. An essay does not have that luxury because it's only got 5 pages, 10 pages, whatever it is. So it has to kind of cut to the chase, make an argument, and then let you decide what you think. Now, akin to an essay is the beautiful art form of a short story. And today we're talking about a short story. There are so many great short story writers out there, but this week I got a chance to experience for the first time the work of a gentleman named Ralph Ellison, who was born in 1914 and passed in 1994. Now, Ellison is this hugely impactful writer. He wrote a book called The Invisible Man, which became the work that made him famous. I have not read The Invisible Man yet, so I cannot recommend it to you, but I have purchased it and I will be reading it, and I'll let you know how that goes. But I did get a chance to read some of his short story works, and one of which had a really big impact on me. The story is called King of the Bingo Game. That's right, King of the Bingo Game. Now, King of the Bingo Game can be found online. If you search Ralph Ellison, King of the Bingo Game, PDF, you'll find a copy of it for free online. There's a university that's posted it. I can't remember what the university is, but I will tell you this, the quality of that copy is pretty bad. It's sort of hard to read, but it is free. However, if you want to explore this story in detail and have a nice copy of it, you can buy a collection of his short stories titled Flying Home. And in that, I think there's like 9 or 10 short stories. King of the Bingo Game is one of them. Now, I don't want to ruin this story for you, but I want to give you a sense of why it is worth your time to read. It's only a few pages long, and it is the story of a young black man in the 1940s who is on his last leg and has a wife who is dying, and he is sort of put under this pressure of playing a bingo game, of gambling his last few cents to buy a bingo card in order to potentially win the jackpot to get some money to pay for the medical bills his wife has. This whole theory wraps around the idea of the fact that there are games being played in society that are often lose-lose sort of games or games that you simply cannot win. And Ellison is making an argument in this short story that for a black man in the 1940s, it is vital that you avoid these kinds of games as a solution to your problems, a quick fix solution. Instead, it is better to work hard, to do what is respectful so that you can build your selfhood, your identity, and become a man of honor. Really going out and doing the quick fix scheme sort of thing is not the way to go about it. So he's making a case for that here. And he's really sort of calling just society in general to sort of step up and do the hard work of being reliable. Now, it's interesting because this whole story, you can layer on top of it the concept of game theory. Game theory is this really interesting idea. It's a field of study that uses mathematics and logic to best understand the moves we should make when playing a game. Now, what is a game? Well, it's not just the games you might be thinking of, like chess or bingo or any of those other things, but games are any moment or interaction where two or more sort of decision-making entities are at play. So this could be two animals fighting over, you know, a meal. It could be a husband and wife in a marriage. It could be 10 kids in a swimming pool playing water polo. It can be you and your boss at work trying to negotiate a raise. It really is this interaction environment where one person's decisions and best moves are entirely dependent on what the other player or players choose to do. And we are trying to use math and logic to sort of determine the best set of choices each player should make to optimize their outcomes. Okay, super nerdy, but if you've seen the movie A Beautiful Mind with Russell Crowe, Russell Crowe portrays a Princeton mathematician named John Nash. And John Nash had this theory around these games that you could ultimately define the best set of choices for each player. And you end up with really what are called dominant strategies and dominated strategies. All of that is outside of the scope of this podcast. But what I want you to think about is that when interactions come into play, each person is analyzing everybody else in the room to try and figure out, what should I do next? Ellison's story, King of the Bingo Game, is this beautiful example of game theory, because you've got this young black man who has nothing to lose. His wife is dying. He needs money. And he goes in to play this game. In this case, it is a real game, a game of bingo. And his interaction with the game players and the crowd and the choices he makes are all wrapped around this idea of him playing from a dominated strategy. Essentially, this guy is trying to, for once in his life, get a break, to control something, to feel like he has the ability to get ahead, but he's not doing it in a very, respectful way. He's in this sort of seedy movie theater, which hosts this like rigged sort of bingo game, and he's just not in a good place game theory wise. And so what Ellison is arguing here is that we should avoid these types of gambles because, you know, they're this sort of panacea, this sort of cure-all for our problems. They don't work. And instead, we should really just do the honorable thing and go out and work hard. What I love most about Ellison's story here is that he's such an intelligent writer. He's not making a case of racial prejudice, right? He could have. He's not blaming white people for black people's socioeconomic statuses. He's not doing any of that. He's simply saying that for black people in early American culture, it is really critical that they don't let themselves get trapped in these games, because there are societal games that will control people, right? No matter who you are, you can get caught up in these games. And he was really wanting, you know, the black people in America to have the best chance possible to make a good name for themselves. Now, Ellison being one, I don't know his full background. I'd like to learn more about him. Again, I'm newly exposed to him, but he was a very educated person. He originally was this jazz lover. He studied classical music. He went to Alabama, the Tuskegee Institute, and he wanted to be a composer. But then 3 years later, he goes to New York, and he's only there to stay for a few days or whatever, but he meets the poet Langston Hughes and the novelist Richard Wright. Well, while he's there, they get a hold of some of his stories, and they're like, wow, Ellison, this is really good stuff. So they encourage him to stay in New York and to continue publishing short stories and essays and what have you. And eventually he writes The Invisible Man, which becomes a best-selling sort of National Book Award-winning novel. And it's great. I'm really excited to read The Invisible Man. But again, I need to read it before I recommend it. Hey, if you found this episode of the Read Well podcast helpful, I would love to ask a huge favor of you. I'm trying to get more reviews on Apple Podcasts. Right now we're up to 42 reviews, I think. And it's put me at a 4.7 star rating. It's weird because somebody posted a review on there that has nothing to do with me. I don't know if it was spam or whatever, but they gave me like a 2-star review and talked about muscle relaxers. I don't know why that stuff happens, but I'm having a really hard time getting that off of the review board and only letting the actual ones come through. So really, my call here is for anybody listening to the podcast, if you find these episodes helpful and beneficial in any way, I would really appreciate sort of your help in defending against this weird stuff, to jump on there and just leave me a little note, let me know how I'm doing, and let the world know if you find these episodes helpful. As always, I appreciate you being here, and I encourage you to take time to slow down and pick up the book. One last thought. I write about reading every day, the art of reading deeply. And last week, one of my posts really sort of hit well, and a lot of people seemed to like it. And I called it the art of returning. And the idea is simple. When you are reading a book, you'll often find yourself getting distracted. Your mind is going to wander, your sort of situational analysis will change, and you'll not want to read the book, and then you will, and so on. And really, what you're trying to do is not beat yourself up when that happens, right? You're not supposed to feel bad when your mind wanders, but instead the job, much like in meditation, is to return to the book. You see, in meditation, the goal isn't to sit there in perfect, complete harmony and quiet and zen-like thought, having no sort of noise in your brain. The honest truth is we all have noise in our brains. It's always there. In meditation, your goal is to recognize the thought and say, oh, okay, I'm having a thought, sort of to give it some credence and then return back to the art of breathing deeply and paying attention to your breath. You might have to do that 1,000 times in a 10-minute meditation session. That's perfectly okay. In fact, that's a good thing. It shows that you are trying to train your brain to stay focused on something important, that you're not willing to just let it wander willy-nilly, right? It's a good thing that you have to keep coming back. And so it is with the art of reading. When your brain wanders, when you sort of get anxious or stressed, just acknowledge that for what it is, let it go, and then do your best to return to the book. You see, reading is hard for all of us. We're all distracted. But the very best readers in this world are simply good at returning to the book without judgment. Again, if you found this episode helpful, thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate you being here. Share the episodes with your friends. Do whatever you got to do. Help me get the word out. I'm trying to grow the community here so that we can talk more and more about the value and art of reading great literature and great books. And until next week, as always, remember to read slowly, take notes, and apply the ideas. I'll see you all next time. If you'd like to take your reading to the next level, then head on over to thereadwellpodcast.com. There you'll find daily posts on how to read well. You'll also get access to all of my book notes and tools for becoming a better reader. And as always, don't forget to read slowly, take notes, and apply the ideas. Thank you for listening to the Read Well Podcast.